persist as the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war enters its 137th day, despite global appeals for a ceasefire. Israeli occupation forces conduct raids on different areas of the West Bank, resulting in injuries and abductions of Palestinians in the occupied territories. Also in the headlines, the International Court for Justice to hold a second day of hearings on Israeli atrocities in the occupied Palestinian territory since 1967. Thanks for joining us. Israeli massacres of Palestinians in Gaza keep unfolding as the regime has been pounding the blockaded territory with airstrikes and artillery for more than 4 months now. In the latest strikes, the regime bombed several homes in the Al Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City, leaving a number of Palestinians dead and injured. In the Al Sabra neighborhood south of Gaza City, at least 5 Palestinians were killed and several others injured after regime warplanes struck the area. A Palestinian was also killed by the Israeli fire in the Abbasan al-Kabira area in Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, violent clashes are underway between resistance fighters and IOF soldiers on Gaza's Salah al-Din Road. More than 29,000 Palestinians have so far been killed in relentless Israeli bombardments and artillery attacks since October 7.
Israeli regime is still committing atrocities against the besieged Gaza Strip with American-made weapons. Endless number of bombs has been raining on the Strip for more than 4 successive months, with Gaza's health sector admitting a tremendous number of the Palestinian casualties. One should take into account the Gaza medical infrastructure, which is devastated due to 17 years of siege and also the systematic Israeli attacks. That besides the delayed permissions issued for the injured Palestinians in need of traveling outside Gaza Strip has exacerbated the already catastrophic conditions.
We fled our house in Al-Buraiji camp to Deir al-Balah 40 days ago. We were targeted in the house for no reason. Many members of the family got killed over the attack. My father was among those injured. As you can see, he has severe burns all over his body. We're still waiting for the permission to travel abroad to get the needed medical care. We appeal to whoever is able to help us get permission for my father to travel. His condition is critical, and I don't want to lose him.
According to Gaza's health ministry, hundreds of injured Palestinians, including men, women, and children, lost their lives due to that delay, while thousands are facing imminent death due to serious wounds they sustained in Israeli attacks. Even those who managed to survive have one or more of their limbs amputated.
The number of the injured Palestinians is 4 times the capacity of hospitals, and this number is dramatically increasing over the constant Israeli airstrikes. We have at least 11,000 people injured in the Gaza Strip. Only in this hospital, 2,100 need an urgent permission to travel. The main obstacle is that receiving the approval for any case could take days or weeks. As a result, many might lose their life while waiting for the permission. We demand all relevant parties to set more effective mechanisms that help to rescue the people here.
It's noteworthy that the problem also includes the Palestinian patients with the chronic diseases and those in need of urgent surgeries.
I am Dr. Khaled Al-Saidni, working at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital since 2001. At the start of this aggression, I felt pain in my right leg. I found that my arteries were 80% blocked. Knowing that I'm a diabetic patient, my fellows told me that I needed an urgent permission to travel abroad to undergo a surgery before my health deteriorated and had my leg amputated. I have contacted and appealed all relevant parties to hasten the permission because time is really decisive. And as you can see, I have been waiting for the permission for about 2 months with no response.
Having a brush with the people inside any health facility in Gaza Strip is enough to wrench your heart when you see the injured children and their parents imploring for travel permission. Now the question for the Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip remains unanswered: that who bears the responsibility for this delay? that it threatens the life of many injured Palestinians in Gaza Strip. The central area of Gaza Strip.
Earlier we spoke to our correspondent Moti Abu Musaba from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah. He said that Israeli warplanes keep targeting residential areas as Palestinians continue to face difficulties in accessing humanitarian aid.
The Israeli artillery maintained its shelling at the eastern parts of Deir al-Balah city. Heavy bombardments and attacks were heard here from where we are standing right now over the last night. In Gaza City, the Israeli occupation warplanes renewed their attacks on Az-Zaytun and As-Sabra neighborhoods. They were under heavy bombardments and several residential buildings were destroyed. At least three residential buildings were targeted and destroyed by those airstrikes. The eastern part of Gaza City also witnessed heavy bombardments of the Israeli artillery that maintained shelling those areas amid fierce clashes and gunfights between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli occupation forces. And in the meantime, it's worth mentioning that the Israeli occupation forces allowed limited amounts of the humanitarian aid to reach the outskirts of Gaza City to the south, and they enforced those trucks to unload those humanitarian aid near the Israeli tanks and the Israeli checkpoints initiated in those areas. And despite the heavy gunfire of those Israeli tanks, the Palestinian civilians who are hit by the starvation and the famine managed to have an access to those basic humanitarian needs, particularly the white flour, mentioning that the Palestinian people there are deprived of that flour for at least a month. They didn't eat a flour or bread alongside with their families and their children. They managed to extract the white flour from under the Israeli tanks and under the heavy gunfire of those Israeli tanks.
The chorus of warnings is growing louder every day against the planned Israeli ground incursion into the refugee-packed city of Rafah in Gaza. In a joint statement, EU foreign ministers said the offensive would worsen an already catastrophic humanitarian situation. They said that it would also prevent the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance. The ministers called for an immediate humanitarian pause that would lead to a lasting ceasefire. Hungary, a close ally of the Israeli regime, was the sole country that did not sign up. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell described the invasion of Rafah as a violation of humanitarian law, while the Irish Foreign Minister called it unconscionable. Some 1.5 million refugees are crammed into Rafah on the southern edge of Gaza after being repeatedly displaced by the Israeli onslaught. Israel has confirmed the death of one more of its soldiers in clashes with Palestinian resistance fighters in the besieged Gaza Strip. The Israeli military says the soldiers succumbed to injuries that he sustained several days ago in southern Gaza. The latest fatality brings to 236 the number of Israeli soldiers killed in Gaza since the regime began its ground invasion of the blockaded territory in November. Palestinian resistance groups, however, say the actual number is much higher. They say the regime undercounts its losses amid fear of the Israeli public anger. A member of the Islamic Jihad movement has hailed what he calls unprecedented losses inflicted on the Israeli regime by Palestinian resistance movements.
Despite its limited military equipment, the Palestinian resistance has inflicted heavy losses on the Israeli enemy, part of which the regime has admitted. The Israeli regime struggles to underreport its losses in order to keep the soldiers and settlers spread up. The more Israeli assaults against the Palestinian nation and the Gaza Strip, the more losses the regime will suffer.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, Alu Abu Shaheen said the Israeli regime is not able to hide the casualties that it has suffered in the Gaza war. The member of the Political Bureau of the Islamic Jihad rejected Israeli allegations that the resistance uses hospitals as operation headquarters. He said the regime levels such allegations to justify its bombardment of mosques and health centers. Ali Abu Shaheen said the fact that regime forces invaded hospitals to find no resistance fighters reveals that the Palestinian movements do not use civilian infrastructure for military operations. Earlier, we were joined by a correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, for an update on the Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank. She told us about fresh raids on Ramallah, Jenin, and Nablus, as well as new settler attacks against Palestinians.
In Ramallah, the Israelis stormed the area of Al-Tiri, and there had been young Palestinians succeeded to throw Molotov cocktails at the Israeli vehicles while they were retreating from Al-Tiri area. A number of Palestinians had been arrested. Also in the town of Sinjar near Ramallah, the settlers raided Sinjar and attacked the Palestinians' homes. These settlers also burnt a house there in Sinjar. In the Jenin area, specifically in Brukin, this village of the Israelis stormed before dawn this town, and the clashes have taken place between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces. That, of course, they raided the Brukin area in order to arrest more Palestinians, as the Israeli forces had been doing every day and almost at night across the occupied West Bank. In the village of Burqa, northwest Nablus, the settlers had raided after midnight this village, Burqa, northwest Nablus, and they burnt at least two Palestinians' vehicles and two Palestinians' homes, while they also attacked the Palestinians there. The Israeli forces stormed the village of Burqa, closed all the entrances to the village, and they fired heavy tear gas at the Palestinians there.
The top UN court at The Hague has opened public hearings on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. Addressing the tribunal, Palestine's envoy to the UN said that international law has never protected Palestinians.
Israeli leaders no longer feel the need to hide their intentions. They speak openly of getting rid of the Palestinian people one way or another. They defy the law, and the law is barely fighting back. For Palestine, the law continues to be only a measure of the severity of breaches, rather than a catalyst for action and accountability. What does international law mean for Palestinian children in Gaza today? It has protected neither them nor their childhood. It has not protected their families or communities. It has not protected their lives or limbs, their hopes or homes.
Mansour said the Palestinian people have faced attempts to push them out of their territories for 75 years. He demanded Palestine's occupation come to an immediate and unconditional end. Meanwhile, the legal representative of the State of Palestine focused on the consequences of Israel's breaches of international law. Over 50 states, including Iran, participate in the oral proceedings before the International Court of Justice. At the request of the UN General Assembly, the ICJ will then issue a non-binding advisory opinion on the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. Last month, the court issued a provisional ruling in a case brought by South Africa against Israel. It called on Israel to cease all activities that could constitute genocide in Gaza. However, according to the UN Special Rapporteur, Israel appears to be in breach of that order. The Yemeni army has released video footage showing the debris of a U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drone that it has shot down. The footage also shows the moment that the drone was hit off the coast of Yemen and its pieces being pulled out of the sea. Two U.S. officials have confirmed that an Air Force MQ-9 Reaper drone was shot down in the Red Sea. This is the second time since November 2023 that Yemeni forces have taken out a Reaper drone. On Monday, Yemeni forces also targeted two U.S. ships and a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. The Yemeni army spokesman said the British vessel later sank. Yahya Sari stressed that the army would continue to target U.S. and U.K. vessels in response to attacks by the two countries on Yemen and in solidarity with the Palestinians.
Watch out! And yet another operation against Western interests in support of Palestinian in war-torn Gaza. The spokesman for the Yemeni army announced the successful targeting of the British vessel Roby Mar in the Gulf of Aden with naval missiles. The reprisal operation resulted in damage and complete cessation of its functioning.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces, with the help of God, carried out a military operation targeting a British ship in the Gulf of Aden, Roby Mar, with a number of appropriate naval missiles. The results of the operation were the following. The ship was seriously damaged, causing it to stop completely. As a result of the extensive damage the ship suffered, it is now at risk of sinking in the Gulf of Aden. During the operation, we made sure that the ship's crew exited safely.
The Yemeni army also shut down an American MQ-9 drone in Hodeidah while it was engaged in hostile actions against the Arab country. Experts interpret this operation as a message to the U.S. and the U.K. that Yemeni naval operations will continue until Israel ends its genocidal war in Gaza.
The military operations carried out by the Yemeni naval forces and their targeting of American ships and drones will not stop unless the aggression against our brothers in Gaza stops. This is a new victory for the Yemeni army. Indeed, we are not strong in the face of the world, but we trust that God is the one who supports us.
Yemenis have asserted that the retaliatory operations will not end as long as the Gaza war and all-out U.S. support for Israelis continue. Since the start of the Israeli military campaign against the Gaza Strip, the Yemeni army has conducted naval operations against Israeli-bound vessels in solidarity with the Palestinians. They have also launched numerous ballistic missiles against the occupied territories of Palestine.
Observers say the American designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group has not succeeded in halting the Yemeni army's naval operations. They believe that the US and the UK will eventually come to realize that halting the Israeli genocide in Gaza is the only way to protect their interests in the volatile region.
And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Homes and camps are more than physical structures for Palestinians. They represent resistance, endurance, and the hope of return. That is why they are always a target. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, "What is a home in Gaza?" Rafat al-Arir, on October 13, 2023, said, "For example, when I say Israel targeted a home, what's a home? A home in America? In the UK? Two people, a couple, a kid, a dog? But in Gaza, a home is a generational building. Rafat, like so many other bright and unique spirits, departed Palestinians without having the chance to bid farewell, because the Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza does not allow for loved ones to give a last embrace. Yet, there was one, albeit forced, farewell more than 80% of Gaza's inhabitants were able to bid, and that was the farewell to their homes. This was not the first time Palestinians have had to bid farewell to their homes, and will not be the last, as long as an Israeli occupation remains and Palestine refugees are denied their self-determination and right of return. But what exactly is this Palestinian home Rafat talked about? What Rafat was referring to was 12 square kilometers room made of prefabricated material with a zinc roof given to Palestine refugees after they had endured tents when they were forcibly displaced from their homeland in 1948 and 1967 respectively. This room was provided for each refugee family on a 100 square meters plot of land in all Palestine refugee camps across the Near East, with the camps left to grow independently as a space and people inside a bordered piece of land deemed politically temporary. More specifically, what Rafat was referring to was the Palestinian shelter in the Palestine refugee camp. Today, more than 1.5 million people live in 58 recognized Palestinian camps across Gaza, the West Bank, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. In Gaza alone, 80% of its 2.1 million population are refugees, half of whom still inhabit refugee camps. A dedicated UN agency, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, was established in 1949 to service Palestinian camps and refugees while maintaining a temporary status, regardless of how long these refugees would have to inhabit these camps. Furthermore, unlike its sister agency, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, which attends to all other refugees of the world, UNRWA is denied a political mandate to take an active role in repatriating Palestine refugees to their homeland. This political paralysis was reinforced through downsizing the political agency of the UN General Assembly adopted right of return, as exemplified in the preceding resolutions. The original text of Article 11 in Resolution 194, adopted in December 1948, maintained that the General Assembly resolved that the refugees wishing to return to their homes and live at peace with their neighbors should be permitted to do so at the earliest practicable date, and that compensation should be paid for the property of those choosing not to return and for loss of or damage to property which, under principles of international law or in equity, should be made good by the governments or authorities responsible. Apart from the problematic and contradictory wording of Article 11, whereby Palestinian refugees are portrayed as the ones interrupting peaceful coexistence while simultaneously recognizing the loss and damage of Palestine property, the legal operative wording of the article changes dramatically. Operative paragraphs inside UN resolutions begin with an action verb that expresses the action the UN member states agree on taking. The original action verb adopted for the right of return was resolves. Resolves proceeded to change into recognizes, to considers, and then to endorses, effectively scaling down the responsibility of the international community towards the Palestinian displacement and its resolution. This meant that Palestine refugees were politically abandoned and left to carve into the rocks, to use the Arabic proverb to mean trying to do the impossible inside their camps, as one camp leader put it in 2014. Indeed, Palestine refugees resorted to carving into the rock, although it was cement that they carved instead of rock. Historically, refugee camps are designed with a purpose. That purpose could be to cut off solidarity across a society by creating a confinement embodied in a camp border, to develop and enrich impoverished rural zones, to concentrate and exterminate, or to quell the crisis at hand through resettlement and economic integration. Yet, in all these mentioned examples, those sent to camps create their own agency and resist the sovereign's vicious aims, utilizing whatever means their camps provide with them. In the Palestinian case, it was a space and space-making. Palestinian refugees realized their inevitable protraction early on and that their fate is tightly connected to the camp as a space of refuge and a space of armed struggle to achieve self-determination.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, on Monday, the International Court of Justice started public hearings about the Israeli regime, which had been requested by the United Nations General Assembly in December of 2022. Now, the court was asked to look into the legal consequences related to the regime's policies and practices in the occupied Palestinian territories of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. The question of the day is, will this hearing make a difference for Palestinians in the occupied territories, or is it just more hoopla from the international community? Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Alfred Dazayas, former Secretary of the UN Human Rights Council out of Geneva. And Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. I'd like to start this off in Geneva with Alfred. Your perspective, how significant is this hearing on the Israeli occupation?
Personally, I believe that every hearing before the International Court of Justice creates precedent. And it is important to show that there is opposition, worldwide opposition, to the war that Israel is waging on the Palestinians, and in the manner in which this war is being waged, which is certainly genocidal. Now, for your listeners and viewers, you should understand that there are several proceedings in progress. The hearings of today that will go on all week and next week, Monday, are hearings on the request of the General Assembly for an advisory opinion on the question, legal consequences arising from the policies and practices of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem. Now, this is an advisory opinion, not to be confused with the pending contentious case under the Genocide Convention of 1948, which was submitted by South Africa and has garnered the support of countless countries, and not only in the global south. Now, what to expect? Certainly, the policies are apartheid policies. There is a long precedent of the International Court of Justice in the cases concerning Namibia and South Africa, etc. And the states that are participating in these hearings this week, a total of 53 states.
Well, stay with me, Alfred. Stay with me. I just want to, because we will get into some of this later on in the program, but overall, if I had to ask you, in your perspective, do you feel that this hearing is significant, very significant, or not?
I do think it is very significant because of the attention that it has garnered thus far, and because of the considerable number of states that are participating in the hearings.
Of course,
it is a moral, it will be a moral advisory opinion without the possibility of enforcement. So if you're looking for enforcement, look to the contentious cases, which are legally binding.
Okay, stay with me, Alfred. Let me get Kim in on this conversation. Kim, this hearing comes a month after the one initiated by South Africa regarding the Zionist regimes committing genocide in Gaza. Is this a sign that there is a change on the horizon and that the Zionist regime is losing its impunity, or how do you assess it?
Well, it's good greetings to you, Ms. Hashimi, and thank you for inviting me on the program. It's absolutely harrowing events unfolding before our own eyes. It's like watching a nasty horror movie on a daily basis, and the whole world is being traumatized by this event, by these events. And of course, the actions of the state of South Africa, which is admirable, has brought the core issues of what's really going on into the attention of the world, and it's actually exposing the hypocrisy of the countries that were previously claiming to be upholding the rule of law under the international fora, which they weren't, and on the contrary, they're actually aiding and abetting genocide. There is no doubt that this is genocidal campaign. This is a systematic extermination of a specific group of people, which is horrific type of crimes against humanity. And whilst there may be issues and debates and considerations about how do we enforce the ultimate ruling of the court and how we go about doing that, that's another day's discussion. But the fact that the case was brought so hastily and with ample evidence and brought it to the court with the most formidable team of legal experts who have done an excellent job. I've watched the whole, in the entire proceedings, and I was very pleased to see such top-level advocates were dealing with the matter. And since the court has accepted that there is a prima facie case to answer for the charge of genocide, I think we can sit back and say, yes, there is hope that there is going to be a change in the international platform in terms of upholding the rule of law equally to all peoples of the world, okay. Not to some people and like others. And I can go on to comment on the matter of the current hearing that brought by the General Assembly. That itself is very important, because in this debate we are, even though it's not legally binding, etc., etc., we are debating now and considering what has been going on for the past 70 years and more in terms of the behavior of the occupier. I mean, and then we go on to discuss the position of the people of the occupied. Are they resistance fighters or are they terrorists? That's a very important issue that needs to be debated and discussed, rather than allowing the countries that have been bullying the world for decades now and issuing sanctions and labeling everybody and anybody who disagreed with them on a very important moral issue like crimes against humanity and genocide and war crimes.
Okay.
This is what we have been discussing also in relation to Yemen, as you will recall, Ms. Hashimi. A lot of the wrongdoings were going on in Yemen as well. Yemen has had the misfortune of having medium-range nuclear weapon used on it in Atan and Nakum, and it is alleged that it was done by Israeli jets. And that itself was never investigated and debated on the four world platform. So it is a great opportunity for the international community to have these cases debated now and determine once and for all what is really going on here.
All right. Okay, stay with me, Kim. So sorry.
Okay.
But Alfred, okay. So you were nodding your head with when Kim was explaining various parts of her answer. Because my next question is saying that basically this hearing, as you had already alluded to, is basically non-binding. So what is the significance? I think that Kim opened up part of that. I'd like to hear your explanation and expand on that.
Back in 2004, the International Court of Justice adopted an earlier advisory opinion on Israel, a school book example of a perfect advisory opinion listing all of the treaties that Israel had broken, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, etc. The court also formulated very concrete, pragmatic recommendations, all of them ignored by Israel with the support of the United States, which has again and again abused the right of veto in the Security Council to shield Israel from any sanctions or any legal consequences. Matters are changing, though. It's a question of perception. I see that the United States and Israel are more and more isolated in the world. There is a global majority that supports the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. This is a right that has been affirmed countless times by the General Assembly, by the Economic and Social Council, by UNESCO, even by the Security Council. But of course, in the case of the Security Council, when it comes to action, to enforcement, then you're certain to have a veto on the part of the United States. This brings me in with the momentum that I see. This is the moment for a group of states. We already say that there is consensus among countries like Algeria and Djibouti and South Africa, etc. Indonesia, by the way. It should be possible to submit a new application to the International Court of Justice against those countries that are complicit in the genocide. Obviously, if you deliver to Israel the weapons that are being used to perpetrate the genocide, you are complicit. You are doing it deliberately. You're making money on it. You know what you're doing. Article 3, little e, of the Genocide Convention makes the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany complicit in the genocide.
Can I just jump in here, Alfred? Sorry to interrupt. Can I just jump in here with what you're saying, they would be complicit because they're going against actually something that the UN has already stated, the Security Council has already stated, especially today it was brought up about helping in the occupied territories and that it's against the law. At the end of the day, I want to know, does it make a difference? Will they have to pay? Can they stop these states from doing what they're doing?
Well, the United Nations does not have an army. The blue helmets are provided for by states when there is a decision of the Security Council. And you're not going to have a decision of the Security Council on this particular issue. But states can take individual action against the United States and against Israel. I think the time has come for 50 countries, 100 countries, 150 countries to break diplomatic relations with Israel because of the genocide, to indicate that they are not going to play the game.
Okay.
And they are not going to tolerate that genocide be occurring before our eyes.
All right, are we there though? Let me switch over back to London. Kim, do you think that we're there? Do you think that, as Alfred had said, that 50 states should cut ties with the regime and basically denounce it for the genocide is committing? Are we there yet? Because we know the price that they would have to pay via from the United States and the hegemonic bloc. I mean, your thoughts on that, Kim?
Well, yes, unfortunately, I totally agree with the idea of not only 150 countries, more than those. There's 193 member states in the UN. And so more than that need to get together and say, well, we don't want this to happen to us. Therefore, we will not allow it to happen to others like the Palestinian people. And the issue here is regime changes, sanctions, the usual bullying tactics that will be used by the regular bully boys at the UN Security Council. And a lot of countries will be frightened of that. And there's, of course, the issue of debts and debt reliefs and aid and all of that. But there is one brave country that has taken the stand and sought to enforce the UN opinion in terms of needing to prevent the genocide, and that's the Yemen. The Yemen's actions in terms of preventing ships going to Israel is partly this enforcement mechanism that the Yemenis, who have experienced the worst part of the failure to uphold the rule of law under the international system, have now learned the lessons from their own bad experiences, and now they feel for the people of Gaza, and that is why they're acting the way they're acting, even though we will be told here and elsewhere that they are a militia, terrorists, whatever, but we know that that is not true, that what they are preventing is ships going to Israel and coming from Israel, and they are upholding the rule of law pursuant to the ruling of the ICJ a couple of weeks ago, when they said that there is prima facie case to answer for genocide. And it is well and proper for any country to step in and enforce that, because that is the rule of law. And, of course, morally, it's just repugnant for countries to just sit back and do nothing. It is even more repugnant for other countries to create a land passage for food for Israel via Saudi Arabia and Jordan from the Emirates, and while the Palestinians are dying. I mean, they haven't. They can see what's going on. They know what's going on. These people have been starved, butchered. People are being killed inside hospitals. They are sick, lying in bed. They're being killed. And the gross misrepresentation about the nature of the people coming into the hospitals. Children, a child, Hind, age 6, all her family, everyone who was with her in the car was already dead. The soldiers came and shot her as well. How can you supply food to that system and deprive the Palestinians from receiving any food? That is actually just repugnant. That's the only word I can find to describe the behavior of some of these countries. Mm-hmm. And I know, as a matter of fact, world opinion, world population is totally against them, and people think that they have now been exposed fully as ruthless, psychotic, psychopathic regimes that don't have empathy for any other human beings. They only are interested in their business deals and weapons deals and power and that kind of thing.
Right.
And,
well, let me just stop you there, Kim. You talked about upholding the rule of law. Yeah. I'm talking about the Yemenis. Alfred, I want to look at this because, as Kim just alluded to, there seems to be a transition in the world, the people, the population of the world, and world opinion. Because if we look at, for example, as she said, the Yemenis, who would be labeled by some as terrorists, but in reality they are upholding the law. Or we see Hezbollah, who's another organization, it's called a terrorist organization, but they are also trying to stop this genocide. And we see it seems to be going more towards a sharper vision of the reality that those who have used beautiful words and talking about human rights and women's rights and children's rights, but are actually being shown, as she said, to be the psychopaths that obviously when we're looking at this genocide today is taking place. And the opposite, though, is also true. How do you see that, Alfred?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of hypocritical rhetoric coming from Washington and London and Paris and Berlin, etc. I have my focus on Latin America, Africa, Asia, Indonesia, India. People have woken up. There is actually a change in progress. And same as Yemen has taken action, every other country in Africa, Latin America, Asia can also take action. For instance, there is a principle of international law called universal jurisdiction. And that means that when an Israeli official, military, someone who can be linked to the genocide travels outside of Israel, then that person can be arrested, can be tried, and can be sent to jail. I mean, that is happening more and more. Germany, for instance, has tried a number of Syrians who entered German territory, has convicted them of war crimes, etc. So here you have the exercise of universal criminal jurisdiction. Obviously, there is the International Criminal Court, and there is a case pending, submitted at the time by Algeria, Djibouti, and others, against Netanyahu. But don't hold your breath, because the current prosecutor at the International Court of Justice, Karim Khan, is a Brit, and as far as I have seen, he advances the interests of the hegemon. And one of the first things he did is to stop the investigation of the International Criminal Court into the crimes of NATO armies in Afghanistan, whereas he continues the investigation of crimes committed by the Taliban. So you don't have, shall we say, an independent unbiased prosecutor in the International Criminal Court. But the respect that the International Court of Justice still enjoys, it's something that will not be wasted. I mean, right now, this is the moment to accumulate all of these statements by South Africa, by Algeria, by Indonesia in the International Court of Justice, and give it visibility. Unfortunately, as you know, I live in Switzerland, in Geneva, I am a U.S. and a Swiss citizen. I read the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, etc. Unfortunately, the kind of press coverage that the ICJ has been getting has been very slanted, very biased, and almost upset that something like this could be happening, that Israel would be before the International Criminal Court or before the International Court of Justice.
Right. Why aren't we surprised? Why aren't we surprised, Alfred, with that? Let me cross back over to London and Kim. You know, Kim, the reality is that there's a lot more conversation happening, talking about Israeli accountability. But at the end of the day, as we talk, as we sit here right now on this program, Palestinians are still being killed in this genocide in Gaza. 4.5 months later, it still has not stopped. Your thoughts, Kim. The end of the day, what is it going to take to stop it?
Well, it is unfortunate. It is very unfortunate. Perhaps it's the will of God that it goes on like this so that the masks can be exposed of a whole load of hypocrites on the world international fora and expose them for what they really are, just hypocrites. And what we need to do also is have a network of lawyers, international lawyers, who will vigorously uphold the rule of law in the best way they can in all their jurisdictions worldwide as a backup system, in addition to other countries taking measures as the Yemen did. And of course that may send a message that not only the criminal regime is at risk here in terms of prosecution and being brought to trial, there's also those who are aiding and abetting it. Because there is a duty to prevent genocide, not to sit back. And you can see also the inconsistency in how the rules were applied by the said bully boys of the Security Council. You've seen what happened in Rwanda. We've seen what happened in Bosnia.
30 seconds, Kim. And then we've seen what happened. Sorry, go ahead. 30 seconds.
Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry.
And then we've seen what happens in Ukraine. So the international community, the people of the world, Africa and Asia and elsewhere, have now woken up to the reality that they don't matter. Do you see where I'm going? And therefore, they need to now step forward and do something about this because they do matter. Everybody matters. Every human being's life is precious. And may God be with the people of Gaza and end this suffering as soon as possible.
And a perfect note to end this program with. Thank you both for being with me on the spotlight. Alfred Dezaeus, former Secretary of UN Human Rights Council. Out of Geneva, Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer out of London. Thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs
لا إله إلا الله لا إله
answering a dozen questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sayyid Zain is the special guest speaker from the Islamic House of One for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid. Welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about an important topic, and it is what happens if our wives, or it's better to say, what happens if the spouses become anti-religion, irreligious, or they are lazy, for example, in doing their religious obligations. Sayyid Zain, it happens very much that the people, especially in the Muslim lands, they start their life according to Islamic beliefs and Islamic regulations, but after a while, they start losing their faith. And the life really for a married couple becomes difficult, especially if one of the spouses is going to be lazy doing his or her obligations. What should we do at this time, and why at all such cases will happen in the lifetime of a Muslim?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. So the problem is a grave problem, right?
Yes.
Because if one of the spouses becomes irreligious, or even starts leaving the religion,
yes,
it becomes very difficult for the family altogether. One difficulty is obviously that if one spouse is religious and the other one is not, then they are not on the same wavelength. They're not, you know, together. But the biggest, I believe, problem would be for the children, right? Mm. Because the children, if one spouse is such a spouse, it'd be very difficult to raise them in an Islamic way. Yes. Make sure that they are, you know, they have good habits, good, okay, they're close to the religion, close to Allah Subhanahu wa Taala,
yes, yes,
and their upbringing is proper.
And the disagreement between the parents themselves,
yes,
on bringing up the children based on Islam or based on, for example, the secular, it will make it very
contradictory. It confuses them. They don't know where to go. It's very harmful for them. So now how to deal with the problem? First, I think we have to establish what kind of problem is it, right? Mm. Is it just somebody who is committing, let's say the spouse is committing sins?
Yes.
Or has it gone to a much deeper and a more dangerous level,
yes,
where they have left Islam or not,
mm-hmm,
right? So now if it's established that they have left Islam, right, that they have become kafir,
yes,
right, then basically the fiqh is quite clear on the matter that their marriage contract is void.
Yes.
The Muslim spouse cannot live with this person.
Yes.
But it has to be established, right? It has to be made clear that that person is, you know, a disbeliever in Allah, or a disbeliever in the oneness of Allah, or a disbeliever in the hereafter, or the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, or denies one of the key components of religion. Right.
Yes.
If these things become obvious and clear,
mm-hmm,
then they can't live together anymore.
It's very much difficult, isn't it?
It is difficult, but yeah, here is the red line, right?
Yes.
Like that if the person has reached this level, then they can't live together.
It denies anymore. Everything. That's
yeah,
right. Okay.
But generally, it's not the case.
Yes.
Generally, it's not the case that the person will completely leave Islam, the spouse will completely leave Islam. And rather, it's the case that, you know, they have distanced themselves from,
yes,
Islam. They still call themselves Muslim,
yes,
express those beliefs, but their lifestyle becomes not a very Muslim lifestyle,
yes,
such as, you know, the prayers might not be there. They,
yes,
might not be praying at all.
Yes.
Right. Fasting or any religious matters, they might not be so.
The religious obligations are not observed or disrespected by one of the spouses. That's
yes,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
So in this case, what should the other spouse do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, that's a difficult question.
Yes.
Right. Because it's very case dependent as,
yes,
well. You know, it depends on what kind of person the other person is when they're,
yes,
not, you know, acting according to Islam.
Okay.
Is it just the fact that they're not praying? Or is it the case that they are, you know, doing other things that are,
yes,
sinful,
yes,
right? Such as in certain countries, we have, unfortunately, you know, alcohol and these things are quite,
yes, yes,
readily available, and they're,
yes,
drinking,
yes,
and, you know, all these things, mixing with the other gender, right? So it becomes very complicated. It's difficult to give, like, one...
Especially for the Muslims that are living in the Western world.
Yeah.
You know, these cases happen very much. The questions that comes to our radio shows that, for example, the frequency of the questions shows us that, for example, so many couples who got married in the Islamic land and then migrated to the non-Islamic land face so many right. of such problems right. mm-hmm. because of the, we can say, the culture and the, mm-hmm. the social and religious, political atmosphere right. over there.
Right. What's key to keep in mind, though, is there is no one formula that we can give
yes.
for these cases
yes.
because they're case dependent.
It depends on different stories.
So
yes.
So,
yes.
So now the person who's trying to deal with this, it'd be very beneficial for them to be in touch with a scholar
uh-huh.
who is able to look at the situation, yes. give advice based on that yes. situation. But the general